By the ancient laws of combat, we are met at this chosen ground to settle for good and all. Who holds sway over the 5 points?
Welcome to Now Playing's Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio retrospective series, hosted by Arnie, Stuart, and Jacob.
You swore this was a battle between warriors, so warriors is what I brought.
We here at Now Playing will be looking at the Scorsese films starring DiCaprio, including Gangs of New York, The Aviator, The Departed, Shutter Island, Killers of the Flower Moon, and The Wolf of Wall Street.
Are you with us or not?
These discussions will be spoiler-filled and may contain harsh language.
Poor deep thinkers.
Today, we're discussing Killers of the Flower Moon, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Lily DeGladstone. Scorsese only works with duh, right?
Oh, okay. I'm like, I don't think that's your name, but maybe it's her Osage name.
Lily Gladstone, Jason Isbell, directed by Martin Scorsese. This is the Now Playing co-host who suffers from melancholy, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, and you know I like women.
It's your weakness, right?
White, blue, red, any color.
But do you like Martin Scorsese as he now prepares? This is our sixth podcast with him working with Leonardo DiCaprio. 82 years old, and Leo's 49. A decade since Wolf of Wall Street. That blew me away. I was like, wow. So all those other 5 movies happened within their first 10 years of working together, and then they took a break.
Well, really, Scorsese took a break. He did one movie I haven't heard of called Silence.
Really good film.
I really like that movie. It's an underrated religious drama. Probably not your thing, Arnie.
Yeah, Christian missionaries in Japan.
Andrew Garfield kind of had the Leo role in that.
I wasn't dissing it. I just said I hadn't heard of it.
Yeah, you and most people. It made no money.
And then we did review The Irishman 4 years ago when he made that overly long epic for Netflix.
That you recommended and I didn't.
Yeah.
I want to frame that you guys said yes on that and I didn't.
But it's not like he's scorned DiCaprio. He just hasn't worked very much. And with The Irishman, he did get back together with De Niro, as he is again here. His other collaborator of many times, I think. I saw a TikTok video. I don't know why Scorsese is on TikTok, but he is. And there was a video of him giving an audition to a dog. And, you know, you're not supposed to know it's a dog. And it's a video of Scorsese. And he's like, I've worked with Robert De Niro 10 times. I've worked with Leonardo DiCaprio 6 times. I work with the best, and I want to work with you. And then you cut, and he's talking to a dog.
This sounds like what happens when you have a young press agent.
Yeah, is it his own account? Is there a Martin Scorsese TikTok account?
I think it was the Apple TV TikTok account. But based on that video, yeah, this is his 10th time with De Niro.
Yes, that he's working with Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro is a first. They've all worked with each other before. I think DiCaprio, way back early in his career, made a coming-of-age film with Robert De Niro called This Boy's Life. And yeah, of course, Scorsese, De Niro owes his career in part, large part, to Scorsese. But that they're all three here is kind of a big deal. I'll also just point out, Leo has benefited in the last 10 years as well. We covered Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, his second Tarantino, but he finally got the Oscar. He finally won for Revenant. And recently, his film Don't Look Up was up for Best Picture. It was a Netflix film.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, that was terrible. It was really, really bad.
I kind of liked it.
It wasn't really, really bad, but it was not Best Picture worthy.
I'll side with you that much. I thought it was amusing and didn't think about it too hard. But my point is, they really needed each other at one point. At the turn of the millennium, Marty needed money and box office clout, and Leo needed respectability. He didn't want to become a teen idol. He needed to grow out of that. And they've done that. They have nothing to prove. They don't necessarily have to ever work with each other again. And I wouldn't think, having just read the book Killers of the Flower Moon that this was the obvious choice to bring them back together. How much did you guys know about the story we're here to talk about? This very sad chapter in American history.
I'll admit my ignorance. I've never heard of the Osage Native American tribe at all. I've never heard of this book. If it wasn't for this movie, I probably never would have heard of any of this. I understand there was another movie based on this, and I never heard of that movie, so I'm coming in tabula rasa, a absolute blank, knowing nothing except what Scorsese puts on the screen.
Yeah, I'm more or less in the same boat. I have a friend who has read this book and really liked it and recommended it to me, but I had not picked it up. We'll see a little snippet about Black Wall Street in this film, and I knew that, so once they showed me that, I kind of knew what was going to be coming in this.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm a product of public education from the 80s. They don't teach you things like the Native Americans had their Wakanda in Oklahoma. The narrative that is sold is the Trail of Tears, right? Native Americans, as American expansion happened, they got reduced. And maybe you talk about why or not, but they got some blankets, they got sick, and they essentially faded off into reservations. We don't know about them profiting from the oil boom. This, to me, was a revelation when I came across this book, that this was a story about a culture that did well and then was targeted, that it's a straight-up murder going on. I will just say that I read the book for the first time this week. I'm surprised you never heard of the book, Arnie, because I feel like if you were in a book club in the last 5 years, they made you read it. You were supposed to read it. This was a very big bestseller. It was going to be made into a movie, no doubt. It just sold too many copies. But a Martin Scorsese movie? I don't know. I mean, there's a guy that makes things about New York and, you know, his Italian-American heritage, Catholics. I guess there is a Catholic storyline here.
This is a gangster story.
And it is a gangster story. It ends up feeling like a Scorsese movie, but I wouldn't say an obvious through line to me as I watched this.
Well, I'm not in any book clubs, and my question is, I don't even know this, is this a true story? Are we watching a biopic here, or is this a fictional story based upon, like, is this one of those, like, the circumstance of the Osage is real, but there is no Ernest Buckhart? Is Ernest Buckhart a real person?
This book is very well documented. I encourage you, before we even get into the movie, high recommend for the book. It's easy reading. You would think it would be weighty because this movie's long. It's under 300 pages. The writing is very captivating and not scholarly, and everything is cited. And all that we're here to talk about, what we see in this movie, I would say, yeah, some dates have been changed. Some things are moved around as you typically do in constructing a screenplay. Some things are cleaner when you change some things. I would say this is 80 or 90% the truth, as documented by David Gran in his book. And yes, if your problem is you'd like to see this shorter, there is a 20-minute version of Killers of the Flower Moon.
20 minutes? Is it a newsreel?
Well, you can rent the movie The FBI Story, which I did. It was made back in 1959 when J. Edgar Hoover needed to convince a lot of people that communism, his witch hunts, weren't as politicized and bad as they were starting to look. And so he appears in it. He sanctified a history of the FBI in which they told you how it was formed, supposedly all his secrets, and they cast good guy Jimmy Stewart in the lead. Fast forward 40 minutes into the movie, and you can see Jimmy Stewart putting on chaps, going to Oklahoma, and for 20 minutes investigating William Hale, who is the Robert De Niro character.
Okay, so the movie isn't 20 minutes long. That's what I had understood you to say, is the movie was 20 minutes long.
The FBI story is obviously a huge story, and one chapter of the FBI, a big one. I mean, I want to just underline the fact that the real full title of this book is The Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. The FBI really benefits from all of this, and you're not going to see that in this movie, but if you read the book, you'll really understand that the FBI and America, after the Teapot Dome scandal, was really on the outskirts, and this case specifically helped them reinstill faith that politicians could be above oil and politics and money.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you get the full impact of what happened to the FBI because of this, but I do get the importance. Like, you do feel like, oh, this is a new bureau of investigation. And what I read was that Leo originally was going to be in the Jesse Plimpton role. This was going to be much more FBI focused.
Yes, definitely. And I think it'd be a very different movie. But if you want the sanctimonious propaganda version in which the Osage people have no speaking line and the Leo character is a walk-on, he's like this nerdy guy that comes in and is like, "Uncle, they're getting me," at the end. For 20 minutes, you see Jimmy Stewart be Jimmy Stewart and then go home and play with his wife and kids and all of that. It's a very cheesy movie and not a very good version, but again, it verifies that this is a true story, Arnie, that there are certain facts that cross over. This is not a fanciful, exaggerated idea. This is historical accuracy and important both to the Osage and to the FBI.
And important to Apple Plus, because this was an Apple Plus movie. I didn't think I'd have to go to theaters for this one. I thought that for 3.5 hours, I'd be able to watch at home, pause as I need to for restroom breaks. But no, this is a theatrical exclusive that begins with the Apple TV logo.
Right, and that's got to be the Oscar campaign, right? Because there are rules for how long a movie must exist in a theater. I don't believe Apple Plus wants to give away its wares. It would like people to subscribe, right? If it has the best movie of the year and you can only see it on Apple Plus, that's probably a boon for them. But as of right now, if you want to win Best Picture or even be nominated, you have to spend time in movie theaters. And so we're getting a cursory release. It won't be long before this thing is streaming. I would time it for the Oscar nomination announcement, which is usually towards the end of January, and for which this thing's expected to be a contender in all categories. I did see this movie twice in IMAX. And, you know, you would think, with Nicole telling me this is sound I could feel, that I wouldn't have Taylor Swift songs bleeding into the mix.
I had the same thing. I'm glad we had a similar experience. It must be built into this, because this film is quiet.
So you're saying Taylor's being too loud?
Yeah, I'm saying she's being too loud, but I'm also saying anti-hero kind of works for Leo. You know, like, hey, it's him. He's the problem. It's him. It kind of worked. Yeah. But kind of irritating. I couldn't believe in IMAX, which is supposed to be the granddaddy theater experience, that it couldn't shout down Miss Swift. But I guess when she's playing on all the other screens and the entire audience is singing along with her.
And she's going to take number one at the box office this weekend. Marty is no power compared to Taylor Swift.
No one is.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of frightening how much power she's commanding right now, a different podcast, but yes, this is just a prestige release. And if you go and see it, great. But I do think most of the audience is expected to sit. And certainly with a 3.5 hour runtime, you know, there was a man that almost literally fell on me. He was behind me and in trying to run to the bathroom, like collapsed on top of me. That happened actually twice in two different showings.
There was two elderly women who got up for frequent bathroom breaks throughout this film. But hey, if you want Marty to personally thank you for seeing this, go see it theatrically. After Nicole greeted me, Marty greeted me.
He greeted me too. His big caterpillar eyebrows were up there. I didn't see this in IMAX or at AMC. No Nicole for me. But yes, Marty was there greeting my audience of, I'd say, about a dozen people. You know, more populated or about the same, I guess, as Saw X when I saw it. Maybe there were 20 people. I will say the people sitting directly in front of me, it was a family of three.
Family with like kids?
A teenage daughter and two older parents. And I don't know if they came for the movie. They came with blankets and spent most of the movie asleep. I don't know if this is just their nap time, but they did not stay awake for it. There was another couple probably in their 50s or so who left at exactly the 2 hour mark into the movie. I checked my watch. They did 2 hours and were like checked out.
That's when the FBI finally shows up and it gets interesting. Come on.
If a movie takes 2 hours to get interesting, I don't blame them. But the rest of the audience, I mean, this isn't a cheer movie. This isn't a gasp movie. I couldn't read my audience other than the sleeping people and the leaving people. The other, you know, 10 people were there.
I mean, the thing is, Leonardo DiCaprio is probably still a big box office draw. But Martin Scorsese never has been. He's adored by critics. His films are considered important, but I don't know what is his highest grosser. Shutter Island, I think?
Shutter Island is his biggest opening with DiCaprio. I know that much.
Yeah, I was going to say whenever he criticizes Marvel, that seems to get the most screen time for him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's never going to get a Marvel audience. He doesn't cultivate a Marvel-sized audience. So yes, I had the same experience. It was populated, but the demographic is the same as any other week in the IMAX, frankly, until a Marvel movie comes out.
Yeah, I only had about 10 people at my screening, but I did go, I was going to see this at night because we only had a few days to see this before we did our review, and it's long, and I get up early for work, and I'm like, I don't want to get home at midnight, so I finally just went right after work to like a 4 o'clock showing, so I didn't expect it to be that full. But yeah, there's about 10 people there. I was surprised, though, like, younger people. Yes, there's the two elderly women, but the rest were younger than me.
Mm. I took an elderly person for the second viewing. Mom had read the book. Mom likes Leo. So she wanted to see it. And Mom does not go to the movies. I usually am not successful when I try to campaign. Like, hey, Mom, do you want to go see Five Nights at Freddy's? She's not going to do it, as entertaining as that might be. But she really wanted to do this one. This is like one of the few times. I think the last movie I went with her to was Elvis.
She likes the biopics.
But do we? Let's get into it. Arnie, give us the plot.
In 1919, the Native American Osage tribe were, per capita, the wealthiest people on the planet. This was due to their discovery of oil underneath their native Oklahoma lands. And, of course, white people have come around trying to get some of that money away from the Osage natives, and there have been a large number of murders of Osage citizens. One of the white men living in the area is King Hale, played by Robert De Niro. He's a wealthy farmer and deputy sheriff. King has a nephew, Ernest Burkhart, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. Ernest just returned from World War I. At King's urging, Ernest sets out to find a wealthy Osage wife, which he does find in Molly, played by Lily Gladstone. The two marry, but King sets into motion a plan where Ernest will inherit all his wife's family wealth. Molly has three sisters, all of whom will share their mother's wealth after the mother dies, but Ernest and King begin to plot to have all the sisters killed. Two are murdered, and one dies supposedly of a wasting disease. Then Molly's mother also dies. Ernest is also slowly poisoning his wife. Molly is a diabetic, and Ernest has been injecting her with other drugs along with her insulin. Finally, an FBI agent, Tom White, played by Jesse Plemons, comes to investigate the string of murders. He soon arrests both King and Ernest. Without Ernest there to poison her, Molly quickly recovers from the drugs. Ernest testifies in court to the actions he and King had taken, and we're told, in a radio play epilogue, we will talk about it, that Ernest and King spent many years in prison, and Molly divorced Ernest and remarried, as credits roll.
Now, Arnie, my experience is entirely different from you. You're saying you're going in knowing literally nothing. I, having just come fresh off the book and having a lot of emotions and thoughts about the book, had expectations, lots of them. And one of the first to get thwarted, I will say this movie surprised me in lots of ways for artistic choices it makes, is that we don't see any trails of tears suffering. That this is going to start with sort of this magical realist opening. And instead of looking at the Osage as people that were forced onto, you know, land that was deemed worthless and having an underdog success story, we're going to see them bury a peace pipe and the ground spouting oil. This transformation is almost seen as a negative. Like, they're the killers of the flower moon. The flower moon is this flower that grows all over the fields, and they destroy it by sanctioning the digging of oil.
Yeah, I thought this was a really impactful opening. You get this burying of the peace pipe, and I think, oh, okay, the white man's come and just taken over, and they've just admitted that they're not going to be able to live their way. And you have this really sad ceremony, and then you cut to that shot of the oil on the field, and then it erupts, and you have the tribe dancing around it, and immediately he tells me, oh, this is about them selling out, more or less? Like, we're going to cash in and get rich off this oil. And yeah, I really liked how it subverted that expectation where, you know, we know how it ended up with the Native Americans in this country, and so I expected it, the cause of that to be one thing, and then you cut to that oil, and it tells me, no, this is a totally different type of story.
Yeah, I'll agree. I kind of thought that the oil would be what causes their downfall. Like, the white men would come in, steal it all, and push them off the land immediately. But no, the Osage are going to be masters of their own oil here. They're going to be the ones who keep it and get enriched off of it, which is something I didn't know, and I like this portrayal of Native Americans. It's, you know, a little bit less stereotypical.
Yeah, I agree. And some directors would spend some of the 3.5 hours cheering the underdog, right? You would be saying, look at what you did. Ha, ha, ha. You were banished and everyone treated you bad and you win in the end. The material wealth is never seen as a victory. I don't think Scorsese sees it and the way that it's presented here as anything to glamorize. Yes, they're dressed to the nines and golfing and driving around in expensive cars when we get this footage, but we aren't to ogle that, which is weird for our culture. I've got to say that usually America at this time, if people are doing well, we want to live vicariously through that. But this is a curse.
Yeah, this is an anti-Wolf of Wall Street film by Scorsese, I feel like, where that was glamorizing the drugs and the excess. This is more of a cautionary tale. And yeah, they have that oil, but my understanding from this movie is they didn't really control the money from that oil. Like, we still see them going in and having to ask for that money. Like, they're rich, but like, they get an allowance, it seems like.
It's called head rights. So what they have is the ability to say who can dig on their land. And they own all the minerals and everything underneath. So it's theirs. And if you're nice to them, you can come in. And that's why we have white butlers and the white oil companies, you know, holding doors for them.
I like that whole, yeah, flipping of what we typically see in the U.S. when it comes to servants and who has the money. Here, it's the Osage who have all the money, and it's the white people that are the maids and the taxi drivers and all that.
And again, the irony of that, like, this was actually the foolishness of the, you know, great white father, as it's referred to. They were from Missouri. And they were kicked out because they thought Missouri was more valuable. And they signed this contract in 1906 thinking, ha, 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 you got the crappiest land there is. You can't grow anything here. You lose. When I read the book, I really delighted in seeing the Osage thrive. But that, again, not the perspective here. Oil is a vice. And yes, to start with the tribesmen burying the past and women weeping for that, I think is appropriate for the film that Scorsese's trying to tell. I also just want to say, Scorsese has a long history of working with Robbie Robertson. He made a documentary back in the 70s, The Last Waltz, about his band, The Band. And Robbie came back to do this. He's part Native. And one of the best things about this movie, you're right, when the oil is spewing, we get this amazing soundtrack. I love the score for this film. Robbie recently died. I'm going to just put it out there right now. He's winning the Oscar for best score.
It is a wonderful score. I always like a score that would work while driving in the car as well as accentuating the movie. I think it does. It kind of works as this thumping heartbeat that repeats throughout the movie. I wonder how much variance there is. It feels like I'm hearing the same refrain again and again, but I really do like the music of this movie. Yes.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. I enjoyed this. I agree, Arnie. It does feel like it's on a loop sometimes, that bass line that just plays very quietly, though. Like, I complained with Oppenheimer that score is just loud and constant. And this score, it just works better for me because, yeah, it's there to underline moments. It feels like a heartbeat at times. It's creating that tension. Yeah, great score.
With contribution by Taylor Swift, I didn't appreciate, but yes.
Yeah, no, that the beats weren't lining up for me.
But anyway, it's not long before we have Leo showing up here. Ernest Buckhart coming in on the train station. It is a change of this movie that he is a World War I veteran. That is not the case, but there had to be a reason why he was coming here now, and they've changed the timeline a bit.
Okay, so the fact that, because I read so much into his character that he was this veteran, but he ended up like just getting an injury and being a cook for most of the war. Yes. And it fits his character so well. Like, okay, that is made up for this.
I love that Hal is like, you fed the people that won the war.
Yes.
All right. I've been pretty positive so far in this review, but let me just say, I feel like Leonardo DiCaprio is really trying to stretch and find a performance as a Southerner with an accent that is different from what he did in Django Unchained. And I cannot get behind DiCaprio's performance here. It feels to me like the entire movie, he's talking like he's got a lip full of chewing tobacco and he's about ready to make a big spit only he's never chewing tobacco, and it distracted me the entire film. His inflections, his... I don't even know how to describe the way he's talking. It's not quite a mumble, but it's like his mouth is full of marbles.
Well, he feels pained. Like, he always has this grimace, this frown on his face, like he's in physical pain this entire film.
I mean, he is wearing crooked teeth, and I think he does that so that we don't think he looks as handsome as Molly is going to.
I appreciated that this was, yeah, in the old West, or I guess it's World War I, but it feels like the West, and he doesn't have bright white teeth. I actually did notice that. I'm like, they applied some scum or something to his teeth, so he doesn't look like a movie star in a film.
Okay, those were falsies in a couple of scenes. I got really distracted by the teeth, and I'm like, I think those are some fake teeth in his mouth, but it didn't bother me most of the film, but maybe they didn't loop his dialogue, and it is literally like he has marbles in his mouth. He's trying to talk with fake teeth in, and if you've ever worn those, like, Party City vampire teeth around Halloween, it is hard to talk in them.
So let me understand, you don't like the performance because you don't like the way he's speaking.
I don't like the way he's speaking, and I don't like the way he's delivering his lines.
You're talking about elocution, not the performance, which is, I mean, I'm going to have a real problem if you're saying he's giving a bad performance. He's tremendous in this movie.
I disagree with tremendous. I'd say he's fine, but his dialogue delivery is distracting and annoying.
And I think that's partly because you know how the actor really speaks, and it bothers you whenever an actor affects an accent.
Not always. I have no problem with his accent in Django Unchained. I thought he was great in Django Unchained. I love him in Django Unchained. I'm not a DiCaprio hater. I'm on the record of liking many of his performances. I think he made bad choices here.
You don't know anybody that talks like this. You're living Texas now. He is a Texan in this movie.
And everybody I know who talks like this is spitting every 3 minutes because they got a lip full of tobacco. That's correct.
Maybe he does. Maybe that's why he has bad teeth. I'm just going to go ahead and say one of the things that I was looking forward to, that the book tells you a lot but cannot tell you, is who Ernest is. How much did he know? How much does he love the wife that he comes to poison? Are not questions that the book really is equipped. You know, there's no facts that can tell us that.
Really? Because that is the focus of this film.
Yeah, it has to be. That's what the movie can do that the book, again, if the book is a collection of facts and dates and details, there's no way to know. You can infer, but there's no way to know. And that's why you want movies and not just biographical documents. I feel like he really helps me understand Ernest. He's thick. You know, we don't usually see Leonardo DiCaprio play stupid, but he's a real dumb guy. And he falls for an uncle that he, since a child, he's called King. This is a story about gaslighting.
And I, you know, you're praising Leo's performance. I really like De Niro's performance in here as King. From the moment he's introduced, I'm like, you know, it's De Niro in a Scorsese film. He's probably not the greatest guy, but when he's like, call me King, I'm like, okay, this is a gangster.
Yeah.
Yeah, his introduction here, we just watched Angel Heart, which we reviewed for patrons a few weeks ago, and I was getting a very similar satanic vibe off of him here, maybe because I did just have that movie fresh in my mind, but when you're introduced to him sitting there, he doesn't have the long fingernails, but he comes across the same way. He's powerful, he's evil. You know this from frame one of him being on the screen.
I mean, the fact that he could speak to the Osage people in their native tongue, again, that just tells me he's a manipulator. Like, he's taken the time to learn this because they're the ones that have the money.
Okay, so I obviously knew what he was going to do. My curiosity about you guys was, when did you know? You're saying instantly. It's clear in this first scene, bringing him into his living room. It's funny, you know, we have Leo being picked up at the train station and driving through all these... this countryside where every mansion has an oil well built on it. And then he finally gets to his uncle's ranch, no oil well. And this white guy is trying to be like, well, I don't want that because if you have an oil well, you need to fear. I'm like, why would you need to fear? You need to fear people like him because he's plotting to kill all these people with oil wells. I don't know that everyone is going to come to the conclusion. He seems grandfatherly. And certainly... because Ernest is so dim-witted and easily duped, he can only see this guy as, and I think he's asked, like, are you afraid of your uncle? He's like, he's the nicest man ever.
Yeah, he does come off as a little slow. I'll just put it that way as far as Leo's character goes. And I do have to wonder, like, well, King is obviously manipulating him a whole lot, but like you get this whole opening where he's like, yeah, learn about the Osage people. And oh, you like women? You're not gay, right? You want to marry a woman, right? Like these Indians are great women. My question is, how much was that influence from King who Ernest ends up with?
And here there's a line that never really goes anywhere that I thought would actually be a plot point is Ernest is asked if he likes women, and he's like, that's my weakness. And he talks about, like you said earlier, Jacob, he likes white women, red women, blue women. He just likes women. I expected him to be a philanderer. I expected him to be a playboy of sorts in this. He's going to meet this Molly and be pretty loyal, it seems. It doesn't seem like he's out picking up other women. It doesn't seem like that's really a weakness for him so much as he, I believe, legitimately falls in love with this Molly.
I'll agree with you, Arnie, is I thought that was setting up like a whole lot of, yeah, womanizing throughout the film. It does not. And my biggest struggle, question, problem, what I'll have to really pay attention on a rewatch is this romance. I don't really get this romance, why they fall in love with each other.
That is why I wanted to see it twice, because I do think it is a subtle bit of acting from a great performance, sorry, Arnie, about how you see him rectify what he does with how he feels. And what I would say to the Playboy thing is he is completely directionless. We have one little moment where we see his plan, come live off my uncle, go out every night, rob Indians at gunpoint, and then gamble away the loot so that I'm back to broke by morning. He has no direction. He has no idea what he's going to do with his life. And I think that it required his uncle to point him towards Molly. He had a crush on this woman that he was chauffeuring, but I don't think he would ever make a play for her if he hadn't been told to.
No, I agree with that. And I don't know that he would have gone for a Native American necessarily. He's specifically told to go for a Native American by King. And so this does feel calculated, but I believe in the performance and the dialogue given that he does fall in love with Molly, which makes his actions later on. I question what his motivation is necessarily, but I believe this romance. We're going to spend an hour on it, so I better believe this romance here at the beginning.
My bigger question is, why does Molly fall for him? She seems to be on guard. She knows what these white people are up to, it feels like. She's smarter than the average Osage Indian here, it feels like. But yeah, why does she? Because he's a bad boy? Because he's a coyote, as she calls him?
Yeah, I definitely think that we do this a lot in our culture. Look at any talk show. There are smart people that make very bad decisions in their romantic life. And we wonder, why the hell is she with him? It can be hard to watch that, right? It's really important that we like these two together. And again, this is why I'm going to cite the greatness of the performances. DiCaprio and Gladstone have great chemistry together. Like, you want them to be together. When they're joking each other up, you know, I love watching her because she's got this stoic face. She doesn't say much. She doesn't want to give anything away. But he makes her laugh, you know, and I love watching her try not to smile.
Yeah, that's what I got, like, from these taxi cab rides when he's driving her around. Yeah, Lily Gladstone, I don't know if she's done anything before, but she's great in this. She really won me over. And I did get that. Like, she'll give a little smirk. Like, she likes that edge that he has to him. And I don't know, maybe she just has that rebellious streak that all young women go through when they want to date that biker.
Yeah, I really like her in this film, too. I think she does give a great performance. I will use the word great for her performance there. I just really enjoy watching this. And King warned Ernest that the Osage, they're going to leave long silences and they want you to fill it up. They want you to just ramble on and they're going to use that against you. And we see Molly do that to Ernest here. And Ernest has to learn. Molly teaches him to basically shut up.
Yeah. And I think that moment is also works as another layer for the audience that might be impatient is slow down. I'm not going to tell the story fast. I could. Some other directors could definitely get all of this in under 2 hours. I'm going to go at the Osage pace. It's a choice. And I think this is the moment in the movie that tells you you need to adjust to this. Why does she like this coyote? Because she calls him out on it. You know, he's not smart. His attempts at flattery are cringe. You know, he's like, you got a great house. You got pretty skin. It's just like, oh my God, dude, this is awful. And she's like, coyote wants money. But they have this date. And I really look at him and maybe white culture for her as vice. They smoke cigarettes. They drink whiskey.
She's got the diabetes. She can't stay away from those white cakes.
Yeah. Why do you do things that you know are bad for you? Because they feel good, damn it. That's how she looks at Ernest. And what's interesting is she knows from the get-go. She's the one that asks, are you afraid of your uncle? I've known him since I've been a child. She knows the uncle is bad and she'd never trust him. But for some reason, she can't say no to Ernest. And I think she thinks he's dumb enough that she could control him. I'm smarter than him. I'll be able to tell if he tries to hurt me.
Yeah, and I'll just say, as a compliment to Leo's performance here, he does come off as dumb. Like, I don't think we're used to seeing Leo play this kind of character where, yeah, I never think he's that bright, and we'll see it play out over and over again, that he can't pull off a heist or a murder or anything. Like, he's always screwing up.
I want to stress something you said, Jacob, which is that when they optioned this book, the expectation would be that he'd play the FBI agent. The fact that Leo read it and was like, I want to be this guy, and that the focus is so much about Ernest, totally changes the entire story. Suddenly, we're not in a story about finding justice for martyred people. We're in a story about why people do things to hurt people they love. It's clear he loves her, and it's clear that he knows that he's killing her people. And how do you rectify that? It's an interesting take on the material.
It is an interesting take. I wish it was further explored. I feel like this movie shows a lot without actually doing a lot of character exploration. I am left questioning a lot of motivations. I'm left questioning a lot of why do people take some of the actions they take in this film. And in 3.5 hours, and with these actors here, I shouldn't be left with a lot of those questions that I am. I find this a very unfulfilling watch due to that.
I hate to frame it this way because I like it when directors take risks, but because this is in the same series for us as The Aviator, artistic douchebaggery, like I'll just bring up that term again. And yeah, I do feel like Scorsese has a deliberate pace. Like he definitely has a viewpoint that he wants to sell here. And like, yeah, you either have to go with that or you might be really bored because this is a slow, it's not just a long film, it's a slow film. And that's what's going to really test some people.
It tests me. I'll say right up front, I don't mind a long movie if it justifies its length. I mind a slow movie that feels meandering. And I find a lot of this movie, especially the first 2 hours, meanders all over the place.
And I do feel like Scorsese, I mean, I do think he's going to make a very not so subtle commentary on like true crime podcasts and all the true crime obsession we're going through these days. By the end of this. But yeah, the fact that the editing, that it feels jumbled at times, like he'll show something happen and then like an hour later go back and show another scene and like fill that out. And yeah, you never really know what's going on. I feel like he's trying to put you in the place of these people, or, you know, all their friends and family are being murdered and why isn't anyone doing anything? And like, you do feel like you're caught in this chaos of a real life crime thing going on here.
So what I'm hearing, and I definitely agree with part of this, is the idea that Scorsese doesn't make it easy, that things are slow and that like plot points get picked up and then dropped and then float back in an hour later. And you're like, oh, wait, this is still going on. Keep in mind, Goodfellas, a movie I think we all love, is made exactly the same way. Exactly the same way. You don't track all the mob plots and all of that. The relationship comes in and out. It's not very dissimilar. So it's interesting, Arnie, I think, that you're having such a different reaction to this movie than Goodfellas.
I think I see Arnie's point. This is not as flamboyant as Goodfellas. Like, that is a rock and roll film that just pulls you through. This is not. This is a slow, like the soundtrack, like just a slow thumping bass line most of the time.
And think about with Goodfellas, you've got the voiceover. You've got your strong point of view character. You've got a through line there, whereas here, I don't feel that Ernest is as central a character as Ray Liotta is in Goodfellas. I don't feel like Ernest is carrying this whole movie on his shoulders the way Liotta does. And also, there's just no Joe Pesci in this film, and that's a shame.
Agreed on all of that, yes. The point of view is a little bit more abstruse, and it's reduced in this way. When you read the book, it feels like murder's a go-go. We're getting into the second act, and it feels like just dozens and dozens of names getting murdered. And they've reduced all of that. They've helpfully framed it so that it feels like De Niro is behind all the murders and Ernest has something to do with it, which may or may not be the truth. I didn't see Marty before my movie, but I have seen him do some interviews about this when it premiered at Cannes. And what he said is, I wasn't making a whodunit. I was making a who didn't do it. I know that everyone here in this town is responsible. And so it's helpful to, you know, you can't indict everyone here. You know, we'll have all these folks float in and out of it. And a second viewing does help you pick out supporting players like the guardian, the man that signs Molly's checks, is also like marching with the KKK. All of that is helpful. To play that out is part of why you go slow and maybe see the movie a second time.
I will never see this movie a second time.
We might be going into aviator territory here. But I will say, like, yeah, it does get confusing. And by hour two or hour two and a half, when the FBI comes in and we start getting introduced to all these people that did commit the crime and solving the murder of Anna, I'm like, oh, it's just everyone. It's the entire white community here that is guilty. I'm going to stop getting caught up in all these names and their relationships because it's just everyone.
If you want that, I feel like the book is where you should go. Or in a second viewing, I did feel like a lot of things gelled. I have empathy for people that come in cold because I think you do just have to ride the ride. And it isn't the rock and roll ride that Goodfellas is. It doesn't have as many explicatives and just funniness. I do think there's humor in this movie.
Yeah.
I think throughout it, there's wry observations and ironies. But it, you're right. Joe Pesci, it does not have. And so what you do have is a series of murders. Most of the murders we focus on as being a family affair. Molly's family is getting whacked one by one. We see at her wedding, the first one to go is her younger sister, Millie, who's only 27, but just wasting away from something doctors can't explain. And while they're never able to prove it, yes, she was more or less fed poison by Hale.
Was she? I wondered if it was just a coincidence that she had this wasting disease.
The fact that her husband's going to go and marry her sister right after this tells me it's a conspiracy.
No, yeah. The way that Hale talks about it is like, they're just a fragile people. They're these beautiful, fragile things, and they just don't last. So don't get attached. You know, he's really trying to tell Ernest, love your wife, but God's going to take her. So just know that, and that will help you do what I need you to do to her. And yeah, no, he's clearly done something to Minnie. And then at Minnie's funeral, you see him, like, there's Anna, and he's handing her a flask. I don't think it gets underlined enough, but that bootlegger that they go to is poisoning all of those alcohol bottles. That did get proven. One Indian drank it, and they were able to get the bottle and know they were laced. I think we do have one shot, one death here. It cuts from Robert De Niro saying, they're just great people, to like a man on his floor foaming at the mouth, dying.
Yeah, you get this montage of different deaths, and I think Molly's doing voiceover during it.
I liked that, where it was the montage, and it's like, this person died, it was never investigated. This person died, it was never investigated. And it almost reminded me of the Bible, where this person begat that person, where you're just getting this litany of names, but you're seeing Scorsese-level violence on the screen and being told, you know, this person was shot in the head and nobody ever looked into it.
Yeah, no, one gets ruled, that last one gets ruled a suicide. And I think that's that cruel irony that Scorsese often plays for laughs. I don't know if I'm laughing at this, but yeah, not investigated. And then we see this murder and it's like, yeah, it was a suicide.
Yeah. And again, what does that take? That's not just someone pulling a trigger. That's a town agreeing to look away. That's why everyone is indicted, because obviously these things are laughable. I mean, we can look at, you know, the murder of Anna, because she's next. Again, he hands her the flask. We know she's next. Minnie dies. Ernest is not involved, right? He's still innocent. You know, he's out on the porch. The husband doesn't want him in the house. And he's sitting there saying, my wife is strong. She's not going to die. He doesn't really get what Hale is doing yet. But when it comes time for Anna, when he puts Anna in the car with his brother, he knows he's sending someone off to die.
I mean, even Molly knows it. She's like, oh, she's going to be dead.
I don't know that Molly knows that those men are killing her sister. I think that she sees the epidemic of her people and knows her sister is living the fast life. She's staying out all night. She's drinking. She's got a gun in her purse. And we see her blowing in while Ernest's family is visiting, actually, and makes this big scene of saying that Ernest's brother has impregnated her.
What I took from Molly's statement is that, yes, Anna is just living a dangerous life. And I think it said she's going to pull the gun on the wrong person sometime. And so I don't think Molly knows Anna's going to die that night, but that Anna is on a path to a violent end.
Yes, for sure. And that's why she doesn't want her to leave. The mom is like, stay with me. You're my favorite child. Favorite probably because she's the only one that is not marrying a white man. You know, all of the other ones are, you know, getting mixed up in this culture that the mom clearly does not trust or respect. And yes, so the sister that she winds up in the creek, Ernest knew that his brother was probably going to do it. They have a dialogue exchange where, I don't know, threats are intimated, but certainly by the time that he and his wife are walking up to the body on ice, he knows that his brother did that. He knows that Hale ordered that and doesn't signal any of that to Molly.
And you talk about when that body's on ice, this is where like things start getting confusing, and then maybe like an hour and a half, they'll get explained, but you see these doctors like cutting it her skull off or something. I'm like, what are they doing? And they talk about how she couldn't have an open casket because her face was all cut up. I'm like, well, why were the doctors doing this? It's going to get all explained later that they're looking for the bullet so they can hide that evidence. But yeah, it like that is some of the confusion, is that Scorsese will do that. He'll set something up and then you got to wait a long time for that payoff to come or the explanation.
That's why I'm really endorsing this second viewing, because I think things become much more clear after you have an overview. Even I, having read the book, felt like the movie was hard to follow in the first viewing, but really came together in a second viewing. Yeah, those doctors, those are the same doctors, by the way, that Hale is going to have bring in magical insulin from Canada, from a cow's pancreas, and say that this is the cure-all for your diabetes, Molly. Just keep taking this and you'll be fine. She doesn't trust him, and we see her stop it, but because Ernest volunteers to give it to her, she'll take the poison from Ernest, but she won't take it from anybody else in town. That's the interesting thing about Molly.
Well, she even tells Ernest, you go pick it up from the train. Don't even let those doctors touch this stuff. She doesn't know that he's also been given something else to dump into that insulin, to mix it with. That's the thing that's actually making her sick, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and she's having, I mean, there's even these, again, I talk about magical realism. Her mom had a vision of an owl right before she dies.
Was that a real owl? That owl looks amazing.
Isn't it amazing? I don't know.
It can't be CGI.
I would tend to think that it's an actor owl.
A practical owl. Yeah.
I thought it was CGI from the way it moved, but I couldn't tell for sure. If it's CGI, I mean, they spent $200 million on this. They could afford a good CGI owl.
Yeah, it's a good owl. But my point is that even Molly starts seeing it right before her husband comes in with the latest dosage. The owl comes flapping in. Like, she should know. She does know. This is the thing about gaslighting, is you can know something as truth and still want it not to be true and ignore it. That's what vice is, right? That's what addiction is.
One of my questions, again, I plan on watching this film again, but how much does Ernest know about what he's shooting her up with? We'll see a scene later on where he dumps some of that additive into his whiskey and drinks it. And I think that's like he wants to prove to himself, oh, this isn't actually poison or else it would kill me too. But I always wonder how complicit was he with Molly? Like, I know he's doing lots of other bad stuff, but with his own wife, who he seems to really love. Yeah, the fact that he would poison her, maybe because he feels some kind of devotion to King, his uncle, he's just going to go through with it. He does feel like that kind of guy as well.
This is the kind of character motivation I wanted more of. And in 3.5 hours, I feel like we should have gotten more character exploration. Is he claims to love Molly. I believe he loves Molly, yet here he is poisoning Molly. I don't feel like we get enough interaction between Ernest and King to really show the moment where Ernest decides, I'm going to poison my wife. We have kids together and all of this. I could understand Ernest killing the siblings, but to slowly poison his wife the way he does, I just wanted more to that motivation. I wanted more exploration. It's hard to believe that in a 3.5-hour movie, I'm asking for more, but I do want more.
It's there, Arnie. We can walk through this again, because I'll show you how it is. So, yes, in the beginning, I don't believe he thinks that it is poison. I don't believe that in the first administrations of this, that it is poison. He is not even thinking about it. You know, my wife is sick. I've been trained to think of her as someone that's not going to last forever. And my uncle wants me to do other things. Yeah, I think that he is being groomed to do other things. When does he become a killer? He becomes a killer when Hale says, you know, your wife's still married. There's this guy, Henry Roan, who was the guy that picked him up from the train station. You know, the first Indian that he met. And, you know, he married your wife back when she was a teenager, and Osage doesn't believe in divorce. So he might still be married to her. To Hale, that means, and so therefore he might get her land rights and take my money. But to Ernest, that's just a lover's jealousy. He doesn't see that as, how dare that man come for my money? He's like, how dare you try to share my wife?
Yeah, I agree. It feels like Ernest is jealous about that, that it's not about securing that fortune. Okay, explain the whole Henry situation. We get a whole thing. He's getting like a physical because he's getting insured. And then King's like, he's got to live until the end of the year before I get that payout. But then this whole plot comes up where we got to kill him now. Like, this is stuff where it just got muddied. And I'm sure in a second viewing, it will make more sense. But yeah, details like this is where I get lost in the film.
Hale acts like he's best friends with Henry Roan. And they're buddying around and all of this. And he's always, if you look in almost any scene, he's giving him money. What you don't necessarily realize in the beginning here is that this is a down payment on a collection he's going to make. When this guy finally dies, I have an insurance policy, a life insurance policy on him that's going to get me all of that money back and then some. So to him, he can sit there. There's one moment where Henry Roan bursts in drunk and falls before his fireplace. And he's like, there's my good friend, and that's $25,000 there lying there on the rug. You know, like to him, Hale, you wonder if he even has the capacity to love. Everyone that he claims to be a friend is someone that he calculates their worth and is privately thinking how he can profit. He needs this guy to die, but he can't die before, you know, I'm not an insurance fraud person, but it has to come due. You can't have him die this year. He needs to die next year in order to get that money. That's what he's doing. He's basically waiting for this guy to die and planting the seeds for Ernest to do it.
So does he wait the year? Because I noticed this film, like, it will just do jumps in time. Like, all of a sudden, there's kids. I'm like, oh, I thought this was, like, 2 days later, but obviously this is years later. Like, that is part of the confusion. So does he wait that year to kill him? Because it feels like he kills him the next week.
Again, Goodfellas did this, too. It combined a whole decades. You know, that movie moves through 20 years or more, and you're not sure where you are when you're watching it. Yeah, what we're talking about really happened between 1919 and 1926. So all of this is about 7 years that gets condensed and swirled around. Yes, he waited the time to get it, but the irony is he couldn't collect on it because it looked like murder, and the insurance company wanted to investigate that.
Yeah, this is where you get that kind of Goodfellas humor, like over-the-top violence, like this guy has to kill him. It feels like he befriends him, so he has a hard time, and so he finally just shoots him in the back of the head when he's supposed to do it in the front of the head, so it looks like a suicide.
My favorite part of the movie, it's heartbreaker. Ramsey, just this actor, he's not even an actor, he's a real Texas ranch hand.
He's a real cowboy, I looked him up, yeah.
Yeah, he's just the physical embodiment of a hard life. You just look at him real thin, and he's got like a false eye. The way he talks, the way he moves, I just love him. And he's got like 8 kids, 9 kids, he's not even sure. He's a bootlegger who desperately needs money, but he's not an assassin. You know, he gets indignant when Ernest is like, you want to kill somebody? I'll give you my roadster. He's like, no, I don't do that kind of work. But then you say, it's an Indian. Oh, well, that's different. You get the mentality of these people that killing natives is a far less crime than even killing a dog. It's like swatting a fly. That's how they've been in culture. This is a culture that values Osage so little. Okay, I won't kill people, but I'll go kill this guy. But, and this is the heartbreaker, in hanging out with him, you know, he's a bootlegger. This guy's a drunk. And so they start hanging out drinking. They actually become buds.
Yeah.
You know, they should have been best friends. And the reason why he can't make it look like a suicide is he can't bear to shoot the guy in the face.
I agree with you, Stuart. This is my favorite stuff in the movie. I actually really like the stuff Ty Mitchell is doing as Ramsey. And it just is a little vignette in the middle of the movie that has good suspense and yet some humor to it and a bit of a tragic but comically tragic ending.
Yeah. So now it's a murder. And so Hale's like, well, Henry Roan's wife was stooping the butcher. We'll try to get him to go up on it. I'll tell the butcher, you better run, you better leave town, as a bit of friendly advice. I love that the butcher's just like, if I run, I look guilty, and you're not my friend.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is where we start to see people rebel against the Hale influence. Hale thinks he's king here. Hale thinks he can call all the shots. But yes, it's starting to fall apart. And Ernest played a role here. He got Ramsey to do it. It's not the same thing as pulling the trigger, but it's getting him closer to that.
It's conspiracy for murder.
Yes. And the wife. So here's an interesting thing. Around the same time, he's having sex with his wife. And I think by this point, he knows, it's been signaled to him, you're poisoning her. But at the same time, we have this moment in bed where he's like, I'm going to make you feel better. And they have sex. And you can see King be like, why are you having sex with this woman? This is just creating more heirs. I'm going to have to whack.
Yeah, when he finds out she's pregnant, he is not happy.
Yeah, he's like, why are you sleeping with a sickly woman? You can see him want to punch his nephew here. And he's like, well, she's my wife. I love her. And I believe that. I believe that he wanted to love his wife. And the child that they have becomes the symbol for the relationship. It's this sickly child that always has whooping cough. And when it dies, the relationship is over. But during this time, as long as they have little baby Anna, named after the sister Anna that got killed, they're still trying to make this relationship work amid all these secrets and lies and assassinations. So another thing, the next thing that gets Ernest closer to being a killer is he's supposed to find someone to blow up the other sister. Because Minnie's widower, the guy that kicked him off on the porch, is leading his own investigation and probably knows that Hale is behind it all and is going to expose him, they need to kill him and the sister that he remarried. How weird is that? He buries one sister and the next week marries the other one. But the plan is we got to find someone to whack those two. And this is a guy that doesn't drink. You can't give him a poison bottle. They go to the bootlegger. This isn't going to work. We need to hire a bomb maker and literally blow up their house.
Yeah, you get that funny little scene with this bomb maker blowing up a safe. It looked like most of the money was on fire. I guess he found some bills that weren't burned.
He was always using too much dynamite.
Yeah.
And he does that here, too. This house will be incinerated. There'll be bits of maid that are picking up in the streets for weeks because this bomb maker doesn't know what he's doing.
That is grisly, yeah.
Yeah, I thought when the explosion goes off in the house, I thought they'd blown up Ernest's house because we see this from the perspective of Ernest in his bedroom asleep and his window implodes, glass flies everywhere. I'm like, did somebody turn against Ernest or did somebody do something wrong? And it's just his house was close enough that it got done.
And was Molly over there? It feels like she's coming home late and he's really concerned because he knows something's up.
Yeah, so let me just, lots of things are happening really rapid fire here. Let me just slow it down to walk you through what's happened. So everyone is freaking out now. Like, it feels like this epidemic where anyone can die, Henry Roan, anyone. And so the town is moving closer together. They used to live on these mansions spread out in the oil fields. And now they're buying up houses in one neighborhood.
Okay, is that what's going on?
They're putting up frayed lights, you know.
I noticed that, but I thought they were all on mansions, and now they're in the suburbs. So it was a weird cut to me to go to that all of a sudden.
So here's the real rub. They have rented a house from those doctors. The same doctors that are giving poison insulin, the same doctors that cut up the sister's head and body so that no one would be able to identify the gun that shot her, are now renting them the house. And there's this one 10-second scene of the wife of one of those doctors calling the wife of another doctor and saying, if you got anything valuable in that house, you better get it out. So they knew. Again, this is a town that knows. We'll sell you the house, he'll bring in the bomb, and we'll get rid of this guy before he exposes our plot. Everyone is guilty. It's not a who done it, it's a who didn't. But, you know, the joke is, the comedy comes from the fact when they were originally trying to find someone to whack them, Ernest went with his old robbing friend, Blackie, and tried to cut this side deal. He tried to be his uncle and say, let's pull an insurance scam. I'll have you steal my car, and then I'll get the insurance money. And the guy, of course, is found in the car, gets caught, goes to jail, can't do the job, and Ernest gets paddled like a child. You ask, what is Ernest thinking? He is thinking that my uncle is going to beat me unless I stop doing what he says.
Gets paddled in a Masonic lodge, which goes to that idea, you know, the KKK, the secret societies and all that, which was a nice little detail.
And the paddling reminded me of, like, school punishment.
Yes.
I'm wondering how bad that could hurt. I mean, I know caning hurt, but I don't know how bad a paddling can hurt an adult. But he acts like it really is painful.
He's not an adult. That's what I'm saying. He's being conditioned to be a schoolboy. You are my child. You will do what I say. And you will stop thinking for yourself. You don't cut side deals. You're not your own man. You do exactly what I want, when I want, where I want. That's what gaslighting is. You get conditioned so that you can't trust your own instincts. And yes, suddenly you're making love to your wife as you're giving her poison. And yeah, Molly would probably die too. Now everyone is gone. She is the last of the line and barely hanging on. But she has a vision of a man in a hat coming, and sure enough, at hour two, we get the FBI. Tom White, Jesse Plemons, rides up to save the day.
We've had some private investigators that they've hired, but they've all ended up dead.
Yeah, there was a squaw man, one of the guys married to one of the wealthy women, he was white, went to D.C. to try and plead the case. He got whacked. There was the PI that got whacked. There were other people, too. Again, this movie is condensed. But yeah, the people that tried to help them were all murdered. And we see her begging her governor to let her have the $300 to go to Washington and plead to the goddamn president of the United States.
Yeah.
I'm giving you $20,000. Will you please send help to stop us from being killed? And they do. And the movie does seem to change here at hour two once we have a noble person coming to the rescue. I ask, would it be better if this was Leo saving the day, if he was playing this part?
I think so. I honestly think that this part might have fit Leo a little bit better. He wouldn't have had to try the voice. And this is where the movie really kicks in for me. This is where I think things start to cohere, because the first 2 hours are a lot of character exploration that I feel is very shallow. I just don't get a whole lot out of it. But then once we start bringing in some suspense to it, I perk up a little bit more, which is good because it's getting to be about 10 o'clock at night. I need something to perk me up a bit. The FBI showing up in town does that.
I like the subversion of expectations with Jesse Plemons being the lawman here. I go back with him and like he is one of these underrated actors that keeps showing up in like really good films and giving really good performances. But he started off for me at least in Breaking Bad as the goofy, lovesick Nazi during the last couple of seasons. So to me, he's always just kind of this goofy, stupid guy. So when he comes into these roles, and he, like, look, he doesn't look like Leo. He looks more like a country bumpkin than Leo does. And so I like that, yeah, he comes in as this tough lawman, but no one knows what the Bureau of Investigation is. It's not even the FBI yet.
Yeah, this is, again, the point of the book that does not really come into this movie was that the FBI was nothing. It had existed for about 20 years, and the fact that the government was caught stealing oil from the Navy and selling it to make a private profit, they were deemed as like the government can't police itself. Oil wins, oil corrupts, and this is the case to show that the government is above oil.
I did laugh that when he's like, J. Edgar Hoover sent us, because Leo did play J. Edgar Hoover.
He did, yes. I watched that movie this week just to see. This case does not get mentioned in that movie. That, yes. No one would know who J. Edgar Hoover is in 1925 when this is happening. But God knows that man liked to work cameras in Hollywood, made a whole movie about himself in the FBI story. Everyone knows J. Edgar Hoover now. But at this point, the FBI was a nothing bureau until they solved this case. And they get the Kraken. We see all these detectives. They actually have a Ute Indian as underground. He goes with the Osage. There's another one that becomes the insurance guy. I love that he sells the fire policy to Hale as Hale is going to burn down his land.
I did not understand that scene. That, like, it feels artistic douchebaggery, because we'll see those flames also, like, in the background when Ernest and Molly are, like, talking, and it feels like it's supposed to be allegory, but, like, I did not understand that. Were they watching him burn the fields and commit fraud as he was doing it?
Let me help you out. Hale is broke now. He didn't get the Roan thing, and now they're all investigating him, and people are not doing what he's saying, and he can feel it. So he's got to sell his cows, and one of the people he's selling his cows to is one of the FBI people. And yeah, he's going to take out a policy on fire insurance and then try to burn his home. He's going to get busted for that. By the way, the person that sold him the policy, FBI, it's there. What I would offer is, again, maybe it shouldn't work that way. Maybe you shouldn't have to see a movie twice to understand its subtleties. But Arnie, I hear you saying there's not enough here. What I would say is it's all here, but it takes a while for it to settle and congeal. It's like Jell-O. It's liquid at first, and then it turns into the dessert over time.
Maybe so. Maybe I just missed it. I was paying full attention. This movie had me, you know, I knew I was in for a movie that was going to be a bit more challenging than, say, Gran Turismo. I brought my A game of attention to it, and I just didn't see this stuff.
Second viewing. That's what I would say. You won't see it on the first viewing. I didn't see it all on the first viewing. It is the second viewing that this movie goes from confusing and vignettes to actually being like, I'm watching what's happening to the characters over time.
But I feel like even on a first viewing, a movie needs to deliver. You shouldn't need to see a movie repeatedly in order to appreciate it. And I found myself, especially again for the first 2 hours, not appreciating this movie. You're going to make a movie that people need to see twice. You need to enjoy it enough on a first viewing that you want to see it a second time. Whereas me, I'm like, that was 3.5 hours. I'm not getting back.
You liked the second half of the movie better than the first? Because I definitely had the opposite feeling.
No, I definitely enjoy it more once the FBI gets involved.
And I'll agree with you, Arnie, as far as it would help to know, oh, that King doesn't have any money at this point. Like, that was not clear to me. Like, the performance that De Niro gives, it feels he's always confident that he's going to get out of this. He's going to tell Ernest, hey, don't worry, you're going to get arrested, but just I'll take care of you. Like, I never got that King was in these dire straits, that he has lost everything at this point.
No, I didn't get that either.
Oh, very clearly, you see him starting to whack people.
He's always been whacking people, though.
No, he's always been whacking Indians and cleaning up at the bank. But now he's killing white people. He's killing the people that did his work to cover his tracks. We see him, like, go to Blackie, the guy that stole the car. Like, thanks for not saying anything. Why don't you go do this bank job and I'll have the law enforcement waiting for you to gun you down? Only they don't gun him down, and that'll be a problem for him.
He's the one that doesn't get gunned down, yeah.
Yeah, the bomb maker, you know, like, why don't you rob this store and I'll... I love that he buys... You want to talk about desperate. He buys a ballet school, and at the ribbon cutting for the ballet school, he's telling the shop owner, okay, at 11 o'clock, be there with the shotgun and take this criminal out. That, to me, looks like sweat.
See, to me, it felt like, oh, the FBI's in town. I got to start covering my tracks.
Yeah, I'm scared.
Yeah, I think both are correct. I think I took it as the FBI got him to the point of covering his tracks out of fear.
Yes, and part of that fear is I don't have my cash and resources, so I'm going to burn my land, sell my cattle, and that's just getting me more and more in the hole. The other thing that happens, the other break that the FBI has is, and this character doesn't make a huge impression, unfortunately, but Kelsey Morrison is an old war buddy of Leo. Like we saw in the early scenes, he was dancing for a long time at the wedding. And I think he was one of the people that they robbed the Indians together in the early days. His grift is that he poisoned some Indian and is now fleeing to Mexico to murder her children. And they catch him at the border.
This is the one laugh that I got from the audience when he's meeting with that lawyer. And the lawyer's like, are you saying you're going to kill those children? And like, people did laugh at that moment.
Well, only if it's profitable.
Yeah.
I'm not going to kill them if I don't financially get their head rights.
Only if it will get me their inheritance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And again, it's exaggerated for comedy's sake. But when you look at the history, this is more or less the attitude. This is not an exaggeration of what this town was doing to these people.
I mean, we saw earlier a newsreel that King is watching about Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma. If we ever review that Watchmen HBO Max series, like, it got a very impactful scene about this whole historical event, like, where, yeah, successful black people cannot survive in America, so we're going to burn their city down.
This is like watching a race riot in slow motion. It's happening. You talk about slow. It's like, rather than just burn it all down in one night, we're just going to do genocide, but it's going to take 5 years. But, you know, Hale is confident. He keeps saying, the oil's going to run out. Their luck's going to run out. I'm going to have all the head rights. And at this point, Molly has been saved. You know, she has been taken out of the house and being rehabilitated. He's running to his nephew and being like, you need to sign these papers, because if anything happens to you, I want that money.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the performance during that scene. De Niro, I think, is really bringing his A game to this movie. I diss DiCaprio, but De Niro, he's had kind of a rough go of it ever since Meet the Fockers. I don't know that I've really loved him in anything, but he's good here.
That is my impression of De Niro in his later years, is like, not very serious. He'll show up to get a paycheck. I was surprised here. Like, he gives it, maybe it's because it's Scorsese in the director's chair, but he gives a great performance.
Even Irishman, which I think he was also trying really hard. I didn't buy it. I didn't buy that de-aged performance. But here, he's just the embodiment of evil. I can't get enough of him, and I hate him so much for what he's doing. It's a remarkable vision of gaslighting. And everyone's flipping at this point. This is where you see Blackie is like, well, if I'm going to jail for the rest of my life, I'm going to give up Ernest, and Ernest is going to give up Ramsey, and Ramsey's like, get out your pencils, I'm going to give you De Niro. Like, they're just, again, this is always a moment in the gangster film. We've seen it in Goodfellas or what have you, where it's like, okay, once the dominoes start falling, no one's going to keep their lips quiet. It goes all the way to court.
And let me make sure I understood. The prosecutors want King.
Yes.
And doesn't Ernest, like, make a deal where, like, he'll get a lesser sentence and that's why he's giving everything up here and why he's going to spill everything until Brendan Fraser interferes?
Yeah, they give him a plea deal. Like, they're not going to go after him. They want King.
That's what I thought. So when later on in the movie he spills everything without the plea deal, I think this guy's just a fucking moron.
Well, you're missing the big piece, which is that he's genuinely wanting to atone. His child dies. God smites him. No one that he killed mattered. Those sisters, I don't like Anna. She's got a gun. She calls me a snake. She slaps me. I don't like those sisters. They can die. They're not human beings. But you kill my child. When you lose your child, it's a totally different thing for him.
But the child did die of natural causes, right? I took it that the child died of whooping cough.
Yeah, but he was poisoning his wife while she was pregnant, right? Like, that could have been...
They were all being poisoned. The entire Osage populace was being poisoned. And we have a scene where we see that child, because it's sickly, because Molly's no longer able to take care of even herself, they give it to the tribal chief. They don't include the stories that happened to the tribal chief's family, but his son got poisoned. And lots of bad things happen. So we don't know whether the child died of whooping cough or murder. But metaphorically speaking, either way, the death of that child is what breaks him. And we see that in Leo, that performance of, like, he is on the jail cell floor in anguish, screaming at the top of his lungs. And then we see De Niro and he's like, oh, let us pray, and doing his whole fakey, I'm empathetic for these people thing. Like, we can see the difference. De Niro never gave a shit. These people were only money to him. And for Ernest, he really did love his family. And he could murder anyone he didn't consider his family.
And there's a scene that we've skipped over when he originally flips to go to King. It's because he's, look, Brendan Fraser, he's having a real renaissance in this later half of his career. I got conflicted feelings about The Whale, but his performance is great in that. When he shows up as this lawyer and he's like, well, I represent Ernest. This is a conflict of interest. I need to talk to him. And they pull him into this room with all the oil barons. Like, this is a great scene. Like, where again, that gaslighting, that pressuring Ernest to side with them.
And who didn't do it again, right? Look at that room. It's everyone. Little cousin Willie is there. You know, the oil people are there. The KKK is there. They're on the jury.
Yeah, the wizard of the KKK is on the jury.
The fucking jury is all old, aged white men. Yes, the KKK, they're going to decide whether the Indians are experiencing genocide or not. The mind reels when you realize how outrageous this whole scenario is. And again, there are different ways you could have framed this movie. If you had made this about a lawman that comes in looking for justice, I think you would experience this movie more from the indignation of Molly. But what's remarkable about Molly and Gladstone's performance is she remains silent. She says almost nothing.
She kind of disappears from the film during this last hour. I mean, she's just sick in bed the whole time until she's taken to the hospital to be healed.
Yes, but then they bring her back with her husband. Leo's just like, I ain't never done anything wrong in my whole life, and I love you, and I believe he loves her. Again, he wants to get back to his family, and when they lose that child, she is there in the courtroom when he, you know, lists it all off. And he comes out there saying, I've done it. I feel so unburdened. I'm a free man. I've got nothing to feel bad about anymore because I've told my story. And she's like, what did you give me? He can't do it, right? You wonder if she would forgive him. I almost feel like in watching her face, she kind of knew this. Like I said, you kind of know when someone's playing you, but when you're in love with them, you don't want to believe. She kind of knew that he was poisoning, and I just need you to hear your part in this. And if he had been able to do as he said and unburden himself and say, yeah, I gave you poison, maybe they could have patched it up. The way the movie is framed, they could have survived this if he could tell her the truth.
I don't know if they could have patched this up or if she was just looking for a final confession and he couldn't give it. You know, you talk about atonement, but he can't atone to his biggest sin.
But, you know, but they had a scene where they met and like she hugged him. And I'm like, no, don't you dare do that. But she hugged him and said, I want to take you home. And I believe her.
Yeah, I feel like if he would have been honest, she would have taken him back. I mean, love makes you do crazy stuff.
Yes. And I mean, we're mad at her for that. We're glad she doesn't. She will end up remarrying and having what's allegedly a much happier life. At least her husband's not trying to kill her. Her second husband. But yes, it's crazy to think that this smart woman, who's known from the beginning that coyotes are coming after her money, would let this man stay in her life. And, you know, part of why he can't say it is because he actually doesn't know. I don't know what I injected you with, but I did poison you. If he could say that, I think that they could work through it. I think somehow that they would remain a couple. But because they can't, she walks away with the knowledge that she had been seduced by evil. And hopefully didn't do it again. We'll find out everything else in an epilogue that, okay, I'm prepared for the words artistic douchebaggery.
No, no, no. This is artistic genius, I would say. This is the equivalent of a 2023 true crime podcast going on with this teleplay. Like, look, I live in a house full of women. Apparently women love true crime. All the girls in my household love true crime. Like, this is a thing. Like, I feel the way Scorsese turned the camera on the audience with Wolf of Wall Street saying, grab the pencil. Like, I feel this is this moment. Like, yeah, here's all this horrific systematic violence, murder, genocide, and we're going to turn it into entertainment for you now. I love this.
I really disliked the scene. I couldn't believe the tonal shift. I couldn't believe Scorsese putting himself in front of the camera. I'm like, why would you do this? Why would you undercut the tone of this movie with this quote-unquote humorous ending?
Because this is our society! We only care about murder if it's entertaining.
And I just want to underline the fact this thing is brought to you by Lucky Strike Cigarettes and J. Edgar Hoover, who both of which have done some real bad. So it's not, I mean, you could have done it the traditional way. You could have just cut to some inner titles that you know, usually that's what you do, right? Show the picture of the real person and say they lived to be 50 and died of diabetes. This is a more creative way that allows Scorsese, yes, to talk about his emotional impact. I think that we see him looking very mournful and reflecting on what happened.
In the fact that this genocide of Native Americans is being, again, told by a bunch of white people. I think the scene kind of makes the movie for me. I'm kind of like, yeah, this is good, but it's slow, it's long. But like, yeah, this sealed it for me, this closing scene.
It sealed it for me too, because I didn't like the first half. I kind of liked the second half. I was on the fence, and then came this radio play with Scorsese putting the focus on himself. And I'm like, you know, sometimes you swing for the fences and you end up with a pop fly that gets caught and you're out. And that's Scorsese, you're out.
No, he hits a home run.
Yeah, I was moved. I was genuinely moved. You know, and of course, just the ironies of what happened. The fact that Hale didn't serve life. That, you know, he ended up in an Arizona nursing home living to be 87 and visiting his quote-unquote friends in Oklahoma whenever he wanted to. And that Ernest and his brother ended up in a trailer park just outside of that whole town. Yeah, crazy. And that Molly lived there too with another man and did die of diabetes. Hopefully natural causes.
Hopefully she didn't lose her feet.
Yeah, but yeah, all of that, it's just funny. There are other things. I mean, the Jesse Plemons character had a really interesting story. I encourage you to read the book. There are more stories that could be told here. But I thought it was poignant to do it as this radio play. I thought it was real creative and surprising. A risk that worked.
Yeah, it didn't work for me.
But did the movie?
I think we know. But Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend Killers of the Flower Moon? Jacob.
You know, it's funny, when I told my buddy who had read the book, loves this book, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's going to be a movie. He's like, oh, I thought it was going to be like a miniseries. I'm like, well, it's 3.5 hours. It kind of is a miniseries length. It just doesn't have, you know, the broken up into 30-minute episodes or whatnot. And yeah, it is a long film, but it's not a slow film to me. Even though, yeah, it's deliberate pacing, I never felt the length of this film. I am taken in by the camera work, by the performances, Leo, De Niro, Lily Gladstone, Jesse Plemons, all these performances just pulled me in. The fact that he uses like a real cowboy, that whoever that actor is with that grizzled face.
Oh, yeah, give him an award. He's awesome.
I had to go look him up. I'm like, who is this actor? Like, I'm sure he's done other things, but he's got this makeup on and I just don't recognize him. But no, he was just a cowboy that they got. Like, some of the Native Americans, they just feel like very natural performances that pull me in. And Scorsese, he's got that camera work that, like I said, with that opening scene, you get this really mournful peace pipe ceremony, and then that above the headshot going into the oil with the people dancing. It should be said that that is the outro shot as well, is this tribe coming together in a ceremonial dance as well. It's not about oil. I think it's more about community, what they lost throughout this film as we see it. But yeah, it's a long film. So like, if that's a thing you don't like, maybe skip this one. But I think it's worth it. I think it pays off the subtle, yeah, gaslighting, as you've been calling it, Stuart, the grooming that King does with Ernest. I found all that fascinating. The love story, trying to figure that out and how much everyone knows. And then, yeah, the FBI coming in. I like all the detective work. And even though, again, I'm going to watch this a second time, but yeah, I got lost and there's a lot of characters, a lot of moving parts. And maybe that's a fault of the film, that it's not all clear on one viewing. Sure, that may be a valid criticism. I was confused at times, but I finally just rolled with it because I understood enough of what was going on. And yeah, that closing scene just won me over. Like, I thought that was great commentary by Scorsese. Yeah, strong recommend for Flowers of the Killer Moon.
Stuart.
Yeah, I'm going to tweak the old adage, the book is better, because I had that experience. When you read a book you really like, and it stirs up all these emotions, and you think about all these ideas, it can be disappointing to see Hollywood reduce it to concrete visuals. You lose things and you feel cheated. And after my first viewing, if you had asked me Thursday, do you recommend the movie? I would have been like, yeah, but blah, 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 blah. They didn't include enough about the FBI. They didn't show the Osage prior to the oil. Molly should have been more of a protagonist since she's sympathetic, blah, blah, blah. The movie I had in my head is not the movie they made. And second viewing really helped me see this as a gelled Scorsese picture. Didn't have to be him. Lots of people could have made Killers of the Flower of the Moon. Marty made his movie, and it's a good Marty movie. That's what I really want to stress, is if you like Goodfellas, if you like the way that he tells stories, he usually tells long, unwieldy epics about very flawed people, you're going to get that here. And God knows you're going to get the two actors that have been his mainstay throughout his career, Leo and De Niro, giving phenomenal, leaving it all on the floor, giving career best performances, really, for 3.5 hours, and the discovery of Lily Gladstone. I don't think the movie would work without her, honestly. I think this movie is so brutal. We spend so much time with abusers that if we didn't love the Osage, I don't know if I could have taken this movie. And I love Lily Gladstone. She is so much of this movie. So those three performances. And then again, if you allow that second viewing and just allow the movie to settle, again, think about how she encouraged him to just be quiet. Take that moment, give yourself to the 3.5 hours. It rewards you. I mean, yes, there are other movies that could be made from Killers of the Flower Moon. Other directors would have emphasized things that I miss that are not here. But this is a harrowing portrait of gaslighting and codependency. And I think it has lessons about contemporary life and about historical injustice. I think it's a very solid recommend.
And I want to be clear. I mean, I think it's obvious that what I've said in this podcast, if you've been listening to the rest of the show, I'm not going to give this movie a recommend, but it's a weak not recommend. And I want to make sure that people understand I'm not dissing this for the obvious reasons. I'm not going to not recommend this because it's 3.5 hours long. There have been long Scorsese movies that I really enjoy. I don't know that there have been short Scorsese movies.
After Hours.
Yeah, that's the one that I was wondering would be the exception, yeah, from our book. But it's not the length that puts me off, and it's not just Leo's voice that puts me off. What bothers me is that you've got a very long picture, but I just don't feel like we've gotten the depth of character that I want. We haven't gotten the deep character exploration that I want, especially surrounding Ernest. I really just wanted to know more about him. I wanted to see some inner conflict or something. I wanted to see him as he made decisions to poison his wife and things like that. And you said he's a stupid character. Maybe he never had those moments. Maybe that's why we don't have them. Maybe their absence is saying everything. But it just left me really at arm's length for this movie until it became a bit more of a, I guess, suspense thriller at the end. And yes, the surprise cameo performances of both Brendan Fraser and John Lithgow at the end, it kind of got my attention there. But I found this movie to be very educational. Again, as I said at the beginning, I didn't know about the Osage, and I knew that I was seeing something real in the historical sense. I didn't know that Ernest was a real person and such, even with the end radio drama bit. But I didn't hate this movie. I'm not recommending it because I think it's complete artistic douchebaggery. This is not The Aviator redo. This is a movie that I think tried, and then by the end of it, I don't think it just succeeded in entertaining or doing enough informing about the characters. It informed about the situation, but I was left wanting more King, and I was left wanting more Ernest. He's so much on screen, but I just don't get an in-depth exploration. So it's a weak not recommend. It's a movie I will not revisit to get this jello out of the liquid that Stuart talked about. I respect the film, but I don't like the film. It's a not recommend.
Better than The Aviator. I'm at least happy to hear that you're not spewing hate.
And I'm going to say, out of all the Scorsese-DiCaprio collaborations we reviewed, this is my favorite one. Like, Gangs in New York, that's a Daniel Day-Lewis film. That's the only reason to watch that one. The Aviator, I would like to revisit that one. I got to put that one for a revisit. Like, it's been a long time. I'm a different person. Maybe it will work. Departed, like, again, all these films are good, but, like, Departed, it always feels overrated because that's his Oscar winner. Shutter Island, it's fine. Wall Street, like, that's too much of a cocaine trip. That's 3 hours of a cocaine trip that wears on me.
Oh, that's my absolute favorite of this entire retrospective series. I actually have revisited that one. I couldn't believe how much I laughed during that one. Such a outlier for the Scorsese DiCaprio series.
Kind of, but all about assholes, right? That's the unifying line.
It feels too one note for me, that one.
Ah, yeah. You know what? I haven't decided about Departed. That's the only one that I was like, is this the best collaboration? Certainly more important than Departed, but Departed is a very entertaining movie. I might say Departed and then this one and then Aviator. Yeah, Gangs. Yeah, it is about Daniel Day-Lewis for me. Wall Street and Shutter Island. Shutter Island's the weak link for me. That one, I don't see a reason to return to that. It was fine. But yes, they make good movies. I will just say that's six recommends right there, from pretty good thriller to, yes, very solid, historically important works. What will they do next? Will they do more work next? They have nothing to prove, but they do have a couple projects lined up. They've been working for a long time on maybe a Teddy Roosevelt biopic that I think even Spielberg was going to make. Maybe that could be interesting. Something that sounds a lot like Master and Commander, British seafarers in South America in the 1800s. Sounds very expensive. I don't know if Apple wants to pay for that.
Another $200
million. Yeah. The Dean Martin biopic that I think at this point Leo's too old for. He doesn't look fresh-faced anymore. You know, that's one thing.
He felt too old for this, yeah.
Yeah, he is too old, yeah. Ernest was only 27.
I kept telling myself, I'm like, he's playing a 30-year-old. I gotta pretend.
He's 50 years old. He doesn't look like he did in Titanic.
But his girlfriends do.
They don't age.
He's totally from Dazed and Confused. He keeps getting older, but the girlfriends stay the same age.
I like to see these two work together, but if they never did, this is a great note to go out on. And they have nothing to prove. They don't have to do it ever again. Marty, again, he's 82. Does he want to make movies still? We'll see.
And you mentioned the budget. You know, Netflix didn't return with an open checkbook for this film after Irishman. Will Apple TV see that spending $200 million on this was worth it to them? Does it boost subscribers enough? It's not going to make enough in the box office. It's estimated to make 20 to 25 opening weekend. A 10% opening weekend would be considered a failure by most box office analysis.
Yeah, but they had Coda. That paid off for them. It depends how many Oscars this gets, whether it's worth it or not.
And that's an interesting game. The only one I'm going to say for sure is Robbie Robertson wins for score. I don't know. They got an uphill roll with Oppenheimer. I don't think they'll beat it in all the major categories.
I think Oppenheimer was a better three-hour film. But that puts the cap on the long films for us. We're going to be reviewing a couple of short films next. Next Tuesday, it's Halloween, and we're going to be reviewing the horror film Millennium Cult Property Five Nights at Freddy's.
It's not just a horror film. It's a return to the video game franchise, because apparently I've been asleep for the last decade. This is a phenomenon with the kids. They love this.
Yeah, you don't have kids. I got kids and they are excited for this.
I'm excited for this. I used to work for Chuck E. Cheese.
Did you dress up as the mouse?
Yes, of course I did. I got stories. I can't wait for next week.
I can't wait to listen.
And in the meantime, worth pointing out that Chris Columbus was supposed to direct Five Nights at Freddy's. He is doing our holiday film this Friday. If the holiday isn't Halloween, we're getting a jump on Christmas.
Christmas comes earlier every year, I guess.
So we're going to celebrate Christmas starting this Friday. It's a 6-episode retrospective series for our silver level donors, $10 or more. So it's going to take us right up till Christmas to do, because we've got some other returning retrospectives. But we are doing the 6-episode Home Alone retrospective series. We thought we'd never get there, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. You know I love me some Christmas movies, so I'll be there with the mistletoe.
Your favorite holiday.
Giving it some kissing. Yeah, we'll talk about it.
So thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode. And come back on Friday.
A true American.
Thank you for joining us for Now Playing's Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio retrospective series. Be sure to visit us at nowplayingpodcast.com each week for a new movie review podcast. The movies discussed in this series are the properties of their respective trademark holders, and no infringement is intended. now playing, is not affiliated with Miramax Films, Intermedia Films, Initial Entertainment Group, Warner Brothers, or any other creative entity involved in these films. Now Playing is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright and trademark 2023, all rights reserved.
The way of the future. My question is, how much was that influence from King, who Ernest ends up with?
And I'm a little bit shocked because...
You got balloons.
What?
You just had balloons fly past you.
You released the balloons.
I think it's my raising my hand. Trigger balloons.
It is. Hopefully it helps me see that. So
yeah,
it's actually a good thing.
And here there's a line that never really goes anywhere that I thought would actually be. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode. And come back on Friday. That's actually a line from this movie, is come back on Friday.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, I get it. Okay, yeah. Leo says that to the FBI.
Oh, that's right, to the FBI.